It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a parenting expert says one of the best ways parents can prevent bullying is by modeling good behavior at home.
First, it's time for our weekly roundup of the latest in national politics. Earlier this week, Republicans on the Hill released their replacement to the Affordable Care Act. But while it's only been out for a couple of days, it could face political challenges from both sides of the aisle.
And President Trump caused waves this weekend with a slew of tweets accusing former President Barack Obama of illegally wiretapping him and his offices during the 2016 presidential campaign.
Harry Enten is with us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Harry, let's start with the Republican plan, their plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. What are some of the initial reactions that you're hearing to this bill?
Well, I would say that the initial reactions, for the most part, are negative. Obviously, Democrats are no fan of this bill at all, but it's not just Democrats. It's also nonpartisan organizations such as the AARP. There's a nurses union that just came out against the bill. And there's also division within the Republican Party, whether it be from the Freedom Caucus, which is the more Tea Party wing in the House of Representatives. Jim Jordan has presented his own bill, just going for repeal. Or be in the Senate, where there are a number of senators who are very concerned about the potential cuts that this new Republican health care plan has to Medicaid.
This plan is too new for there to be polling data on it, but you looked at, in a piece, different parts of it and how they've polled with the public. What kind of things have you seen?
Well, it really does depend. Some of it is potentially more popular than other parts of it, right? So, for instance, the mandate, which has helped to funds the individual mandate, which essentially says you have to pay a fine if you're not on a health insurance plan. That polled particularly unpopular, and that was in the Affordable Care Act. In the new Republican plan, that's not there. Now, there is something else that could potentially be viewed as a type of mandate, but the fact that they got rid of it, that's good news for this plan. However, there are a number of parts which don't poll nearly as well. I mentioned, Medicaid. They're changing the way that Medicaid might be funded to the states. There was a big expansion in Medicaid under Obamacare, and that poll, the fact that you get rid of that, that polls quite poorly. So again, it seems to me that most of the parts of the plan poll poorly, but there are some, such as the mandate, which was a very big part of Obamacare in the first place, polled particularly well, but we'll have to wait and see how everything comes together a little bit down the line.
Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz talked to CNN, was asked how this could affect low-income people and how they might access health care, and here's what he had to say.
We're getting rid of the individual mandate. We're getting rid of those things that people said that they don't want. And you know what? Americans have choices, and they've got to make a choice. And so maybe rather than getting that new iPhone that they just love and they want to go spend hundreds of dollars on that, maybe they should invest it in their own health care. They've got to make those decisions themselves.
What do you think about that comment from Chaffetz there addressing the low-income question?
I think it perhaps could have been put a little bit more artfully. But, yes, it is true that if you look at who might, in fact, be hurt or helped by this plan, it does seem that poorer Americans, lower-income people might be hurt. The tax credits that are going to them might be less in size. But it's also the case that there'll be tax credits going up to, say, more middle-income people as well. So I see Chaffetz's comment and I understand what he's saying, but the fact is that these tax credits that are given to lower income people under Obamacare are fairly popular, but it could also be the case that the way that this new restructuring of the Republican plan, which gives more money to middle income people, may in fact prove popular itself.
It's been a rocky rollout, and people have been saying, oh, it's a bungled rollout, things like that. But this is new. It's going to change over time. Do you think when we look back a few months later, this will be just a blip on the radar, what we've seen on week one?
Well, I think that this is the starting out point, right? This is a blueprint, as President Trump called it. So, I think they could have had a better rollout than this. But, healthcare is a third rail in politics. It's difficult to get things passed on this particular subject. And let's see where we are. It could, in fact, work out very well for Republicans in the end, even if right now it doesn't exactly look positive.
Yesterday it was reported that the House did not want to wait for the kind of rundown from the Congressional Budget Office about how about the impact there that they wanted to proceed more quickly. How could that affect the information that Congress has about this?
Well, you know, to me, this is one of the big questions is obviously the cost of this measure. And Republicans want to keep the cost down, and that, I think, is part of the reason why they rushed this out without a CBO, Congressional Budget Office, estimate, because I think that there's a general recognition right now that that score may not, in fact, be too positive for Republicans. If, in fact, that this scores poorly with the CBO, then it wouldn't be shocking to me that it gives more leverage to, say, those Freedom Caucus people who are saying that this, in terms of budgetary strength, is just not there.
We're looking at national politics with Harry Enten from 538.com. Let's move back to this weekend, Harry. President Trump made waves again, speaking out on Twitter, saying that his predecessor, President Obama, had legally wiretapped Trump Tower during the election campaign. No evidence has confirmed that. FBI Director James Comey, former National Intelligence Director James Clapper, say that didn't happen. Take us back to this weekend. What kicked this whole thing off?
What essentially kicked it off was that President Trump read an article, I believe it was in Breitbart. It's been reported in a number of different places about this wiretapping claim that was made, but in fact there's no proof of that at all. And what was so interesting is if you look at the reporting that's been done subsequent to Trump making that tweet, he wrote the tweet, he felt really good about it, and then started asking questions later. It's almost as if he didn't realize that as President of the United States, he in fact could try and call somebody up before tweeting something out. This, I think, is fairly typical of the President of the United States, where he sometimes tweets things before necessarily doing the full investigations that, say, normal presidents would do. And I don't think it particularly led to a good news cycle for him. But again, you know, news cycles move on. And now, of course, we're talking more about health care than we are talking about Trump's tweets. But again, it wasn't particularly, I think, golden moment for him.
And do you expect that tweet to have legs? Will there be any sort of investigation? Are congressional Republicans rallying to that cause, or are there other bigger fish to fry right now?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some investigation at some point, but I don't. Certainly, if you talk to Republicans, they didn't particularly see that as a big thing in terms of a good thing for them. I think it will probably just see people move on more or less.
And some people have suggested this might be a distraction from the growing allegations of the administration and the campaign's potential ties to Russia. Obviously an ongoing story there. Do you think there's anything to that, or is this just a president who tweets what he thinks?
Yeah, I think that you're giving the president probably a little too much credit in this particular instance. I don't think that he necessarily was thinking about Russia when he wrote that. I think it was something he saw. I mean, we literally saw him tweeting back and forth at the Fox and Friends Twitter handle earlier this week because he was seeing something on TV. I don't exactly think he was thinking it through.
And in other news, Donald Trump, President Trump, also signed the new travel ban this week. Iraq is no longer on that list. So with that, coupled with other changes, is this demonstrably different than the first travel ban?
Well, I think it's different in some ways. I think you mentioned one of them, obviously, with Iraq. But I think another way that it's different is that it ensures that people who have a current visa from those countries will still be allowed into the country, as well as people who have a green card who are from those six remaining countries, minus Iraq, that were in the original order, will be able to come into this country. And I think that that does make a difference, at least in some public perception, because remember, a lot of the rallying against the original travel ban occurred at airports when people who had green cards or current visas or were people who helped out American soldiers during the Iraq War were kept out of the country or held up in airports. So I do think it makes a difference in that sort of way, even if the bill at large still tries to accomplish, or excuse me, the executive order at large still tries to accomplish what it originally set out to do.
Hey, you wrote or co-wrote a piece recently teasing out the public reaction to this on the one hand and the legal changes, whether it'll still be under legal threat on the other. Do you see legal challenges coming to this revised travel ban as compared to the previous one?
I think we'll probably see fewer, but I know that Hawaii is already, the state of Hawaii is already trying to sue the Trump administration about this plan. So I don't think that this is necessarily out of the legal woods, as I think the piece that you cited sort of spoke about. So, no, I expect perhaps fewer legal challenges, but there'll certainly be some that exist.
We're talking national politics right now with Harry Enten of 538.com.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the president's tweets about wiretapping? Do you think the Republican health care plan will pass? What do you like or dislike about what we're seeing so far from that Republican proposal? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More national politics in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And right now we're continuing our national political roundup with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
You can join in with your thoughts on the big news in national politics at 800-642-1234. Call in with your thoughts on the tweeted wiretapping allegations, the revised travel ban, Iraq off the list, some other changes there. Does this fix concerns for you, or do you think it doesn't go far enough or still too far? And what about the Republican health care agenda? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to get your commentator's response to the following analysis. I am an attorney. Obtaining a wiretap without a judicial approved search warrant or a FISA court, international court determination, is essentially a felony crime. And does the commentator not agree that Donald Trump over the weekend accused either the Obama or President Obama himself or his administration of not having committed felony crimes? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thanks for that. Harry.
Well, I would say that, again, we might be giving a little too much credit to the president insofar of him understanding the rules. And obviously, Twitter only allows for 140 characters, right? Of course, I agree. You know, if they didn't go to the FISA court, then, you know, this could potentially be, you know, it would not be legal. We'll put it that way. But in the Obama administration, though, has obviously denied that. And I think Trump perhaps didn't necessarily realize what he was exactly insinuating by that tweet. And I'm not necessarily sure by tweeting that out that he wasn't thinking that, in fact, Obama didn't go to the FISA court, which, in fact, wouldn't be necessarily Obama going after Trump as much as, say, the federal government, the FISA court going after him. But no, I think you're probably taking that comment a little too far, or that tweet a little too far, in terms of what exactly Trump was accusing Obama of. I don't think Trump really understood it, if I'm being honest with you.
Before we go on to another caller Harry, as we did so often during the campaign, we are talking about Donald Trump's tweets. That is something that did not change when he became president in January.
No, it's not something, you know, I think that we kept waiting, you know, pundits and analysts kept waiting to say, okay, here's presidential Trump. He's finally going to start acting presidential. But the fact is, this is Donald Trump. This is who he is. He's going to tweet. He managed to stay off Twitter for a few days last week following his message to a joint session of Congress. But he's on Twitter. He's a tweeter. And that's the end of the story as far as I'm concerned.
And is it being used as a tool now, though? I have seen articles in the lead-up or just after the rollout of the Republican health care plan wondering if he would use Twitter as a rallying tool to sell, you know, the health care plan, join in with congressional Republicans. So is it something that's maybe being a little more directed now in the way it's being used?
I think it could be. I think it could certainly be something that's used to help rally support for a health care plan. But it can also be used for other things as well. But, of course, the one thing I should point out is most Americans aren't on Twitter. Most Americans aren't following Trump's Twitter feed. It's the reporting of Trump's Twitter feed by those in the media outside of Twitter that really gives it the power that it potentially has.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Shawano. John, hi.
Oh, hi, guys. Yeah, enough about Donald Trump's tweets in the middle of the night. Somebody has to watch that guy on, what, Friday or Saturday night at 3 a.m. or Sunday morning? Anyway, enough about that. You know, it's all bogus. But I'd like to get back to actual health care. It is it has to be a single-payer system. Every other country, respectable country in the world, has a single-payer system. It should not be called health insurance like we have here in our country. It should be called health care or health coverage. Everyone pays into it, and we have health care or health coverage, not insurance. You know, I have home insurance. If a tree falls on my roof, it gets fixed. I have car insurance. If I get a dent, it'll get fixed. Health care is what it should be, not health insurance, because guess what? Every one of us humans are going to get sick and ill.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Harry, single payer, I mean, it didn't happen under a Democratic president with a Democratic Congress. It's probably not going to happen under Republicans, but I have heard people with similar messages from the Republican side as John saying, you know, let's not talk about how many people are covered. Let's not talk about insurance. Let's talk about the quality of care people are getting. I don't know. Is John stumbling onto some messaging that maybe some Republicans wouldn't argue with?
Well, I think that there are a few things. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I know that, you know, Sean Spicer has certainly, who's obviously Trump's press secretary, has argued as much as that we shouldn't be paying attention to how many people are, quote unquote, covered, but what is the type of care that they're receiving, because it's fairly clear that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, certainly boosted coverage rates. But is it the case that coverage was actually any good? A lot of Republicans would argue against that, so perhaps there's something there. And just to go to the larger point that the caller made, you know, healthcare and a lot of things in this country are often about moving the ball forward legislatively. So right now we don't, you know, have a single payer healthcare system, and I'm going to guess obviously we're not going to get that under a Republican administration, but perhaps, you know, 20, 30, 40 years down the road under another Democratic administration where they have a large majority, don't be surprised if they try and move the ball forward a little bit more towards, say, a more, dare I say, socialist type of health care plan or more of a single-payer health care plan. But it's not today, not tomorrow, perhaps 20, 30 years down the road.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now from 538.com, getting the latest in national politics. And we go next to Tim, who's joining us from Marinette. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's been any open discussion in D.C. as to the mental health of the president. I'm very concerned about his lack of yesterday and tomorrow. He seems to live in the moment exclusively. And by his tweeting and his actions and even some of the things he says and his lies, I'm very concerned that this man has our nuclear codes.
Tim, thank you for the call. Harry?
Well, obviously, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not in any particular place to comment on the president's mental health state. But I will say that there's certainly been discussion about it in certain circles. It's certainly not something that gets play in major circles. It's not something that's spoken about too much in the press. But it's certainly something that's spoke about in the back channels, for sure. I mean, the caller's not alone in that thought process.
Thanks for the call. Wanted to ask you, Harry, before we go back to our callers, one of your colleagues at 538 wrote an analysis of counties across the United States and how few purple counties there are. More and more counties seeing more landslide wins for Democrats or Republicans, fewer and fewer seeing actual close contested races.
Yeah, I mean, that was an analysis that was done by Dave Wasserman, who's a contributor here, who also writes for the Cook Political Report. He's their basically the person who's in charge of their House ratings, you know, which seats lean Republican or Democratic. The finding was essentially that there are more counties today that are won by 20 points or more by one party than the other, going back at least 25 years, 40 years, whatever the exact number is. And so it shouldn't be surprising that our politics, we're all living in a bubble, because the fact of the matter is that we are living in a bubble increasingly. I think it's only now 40% of Americans live in a county in which the presidential race was decided by 20 points or less, which is an amazing statistic. So in New York, for instance, it's no wonder that most of my friends are Democrats. It's because pretty much everyone in this city is a Democrat, versus if you go to some of the more rural counties in the state, it's not surprising that most people are Republican, or most of the friends are Republican, because they are.
How fluid is that kind of statistic you're talking about? Does it change quickly? Is it mercurial, or is this something that takes a long time to shift?
This is something that's been going on over the past 20 years. There's been a trend towards people living in counties that are more friendly to their political persuasion. I think it's especially the case after this election, because what we really saw was an election that broke down not only along racial lines, but along education lines as well. And the fact is that that's also tied in with income, so it shouldn't be too surprising that I tend to locate myself in a neighborhood with people who kind of look and think like me, and increasingly that's being tied to political thought as well.
Let's bring on another caller. Janet is with us in Madison. Janet, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Janet?
Well, I wanted to say something good about the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. I've had to be on it for a little over a year, and I literally wouldn't be alive without it. I don't think it's perfect, but it's better than no insurance. And the Republican plan is kind of like going into a car sales place. They ask you to sign your financing without letting you see the car, without knowing what the features are or what the terms of the financing are.
Janet, thanks. I get both of your points there. First of all, Harry, Janet, speaking in favor of Obamacare, and we've talked a little about this before, a weird thing has happened. Obamacare is not wildly popular, but more popular than unpopular for the first time ever, basically, right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, it was passed in 2010, and we've seen a sharp increase in the percentage of people who have a favorable view of the law. And now all of a sudden there are more people who like it than dislike it, which is pretty amazing. And it seemed to occur right after the election for whatever reason. I think part of the reason is that, you know, it's much easier to talk about losses in the hypothetical, but when all of a sudden you're talking about people who might be losing their health insurance, that all of a sudden puts it in some really real terms. And I think that it might be some voters who are saying, you know what, let's hold on a second, Republican Congress. We may have voted you in, but we don't want you to go too far overboard.
And Janet brought up a point, you know, we may not know a lot of the details or how things are going to work in a Republican health care plan, which was a lot of the Republican criticism of this big, long document that was the Affordable Care Act, that people didn't know all of the consequences and nuts and bolts of that. We're going to see similar criticism from the Democratic side on this.
I'm sure that we will, but I should point out, of course, there's a reason why Sean Spicer tried to compare the literal sizes of the two bills, both the Republican plan and the current health care plan that's in place, the Affordable Care Act, trying to emphasize that this plan is much smaller, which is true. The actual bill is much smaller, but that, of course, could leave open to interpretation certain facets of the law and could make it a little bit more complex in understanding what's actually going to occur at the end of the day.
And Harry, since the inauguration of President Trump, we've been tracking the polling numbers there. They were low, lower than others. And wondering briefly, he gave that address to Congress last week. A lot of people responded very positively. So did we see a correlation in poll numbers going up?
Well, I will say that Donald Trump is still the most unpopular president at this point during his administration. But we did see, if you look at the 538 tracker and we combine all the polls, that his approval rating does seem to be up about maybe a point to a point and a half. And that may be tied, in fact, to that speech. But it could just be noise. I think we'll get a better understanding of where exactly he stands, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks out from it.
Harry, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joined us this week to give us the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we look at how parents can set good examples for their kids to help prevent bullying. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll break down a new analysis of Governor Scott Walker's proposal to divvy up millions in funding to UW campuses based on performance.
First, in the fight against bullying, there could be an overlook tool to help. Turns out parents who model positive behavior and talk about bullying with their kids can have a big impact.
Given all the attention to bullying and the effect it has on kids, parents are pretty alert to the signs and impacts of bullying, but less has been said about the example parents can set for children to help them deal with bullies and mitigate the effects of aggressive behavior.
Anna Clarkson is with us. She's digital parenting education specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. She recently wrote a WisConText article called "The Best Bullying Prevention is for Parents to Lead by Example." And you can find a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
So why are parents so effective when it comes to helping their kids cope with bullying?
You know, parents are so effective in coping with bullying because, believe it or not, children and teenagers look first to their parents and caregivers for advice on how to make tough choices and how to deal with things like peer pressure or bullying. So really, they're the first line of questioning or information for kids.
Now, in your article, you said talking about bullying is a square one, getting it out there. So it's not something that happens under the cover of privacy and nobody ever talks about, but it's out there and it's a topic that people are used to talking about. Tell us how that works.
Exactly. So conversation is definitely the first step that parents can take in preventing bullying, building this ongoing relationship with their child around talking about topics that don't always feel safe, like bullying. Research shows that just talking to your child for as little as 15 minutes a day about bullying and related topics can increase the probability that your young person will come to you for help and advice and decrease the likelihood that they will be a bully or be bullied. And just thinking about what that actually looks like, I think, is interesting, too. So that means you can ask a lot of different questions. First of all, you can help your kid think about, you know, what does bullying look like and help them understand bullying. So talk about what bullying is, how to stand up to it safely, talk about how bullying is unacceptable, and then also make sure kids know how to get help. So if you're thinking about some questions that you might ask to kind of spark that kind of conversation, some of those questions could be, you know, what does bullying mean to you? Describe what kids who bully are like. Why do you think people bully? And then even asking them, who are the adults you trust most when it comes to things like bullying? All those kinds of questions and conversations help give kids the skills to be assertive and to know what to do in a situation where they might observe bullying or be a victim of bullying themselves. And then a few other tips for parents in terms of how to have these conversations with kids are to ask questions that just keep the lines of communication open. So that means just check in with your kids often, whether it's on the drive home from school or at the dinner table. Listen to them, know their friends, ask about school, understand their concerns. You know, those are questions like, what was the best thing that happened to you today? You can ask that every single day. And you can share what happened to you, too, what the best thing that happened to you was, and build up this this tradition of asking that. You can also ask more specific questions about their day, like what was it like to ride on the school bus today? Or what was lunchtime like? Who did you sit by? And then finally, I think conversation can also build up your child's strengths. And actually being able to build up their strengths, whether that's around encouraging them to do what they love or talking about what they do best, that really boosts kids' confidence and can help them make friends, and it can actually protect them from bullying behavior. So that's even talking about, you know, what are you good at? What do you like best about yourself? Here's what I see that I really value in you. So, just a handful of questions parents can ask.
I want to go back to something you said at the very beginning of that answer. You said if you talk to your children for 15 minutes, a minimum of 15 minutes a day about bullying, and you know, my kids, I feel like that's kind of a lot. Every day you're having a conversation about bullying. I can see that not going over so well. So is that a lot, or does it just feel like it?
Well, you know, 15 minutes could feel like a lot. And I think that's why it's really important to think about, this isn't just 15 minutes of tell me what bullying means to you. That can certainly be a part of it. But it's actually opening up to these additional skills of you know, tell me what was the best thing that happened today, building your child's strengths by talking about, you know, what some of their best skills are or their strengths. And you can even build that conversation out to thinking about ways that we treat others with kindness and respect. So that's maybe asking things about, like, when were you brave today? What does bravery look like? Does it sometimes mean talking to an adult when you're scared about something? When were you kind today? So, you know, these bullying conversations can really be, I don't want to say hidden, but I'm saying hidden, in conversations about values and personal strength.
We're talking about bullying right now with Anna Clarkson, digital parenting education specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. And she says parents' own behavior can have a big impact on how children respond to bullying. And Anna, modeling behavior. See, we have those conversations on the one hand, and you also say modeling behavior where parents are tolerant of other perspectives and personalities can also be a big help. How does that work?
It is a big help. So your example as a parent is the example that then kids go out to live in the world in the first place. And so when they see you talking about and treating others with kindness and respect, that's the model that they follow. And that extends to, you know, even simple things like always modeling positive language. So avoid calling people slurs or derogatory terms, because cruel words are just always harmful, even if the person being demeaned, you know, says that those words are okay. So it's as simple as watching your language, and as big as helping your child construct a story about kindness in our world and respect.
And let's say you are someone who's engaged, you're having these conversations, you're watching for signs, and you discover that your child is being bullied. What do you do? Is it a good idea? I mean, as a parent, maybe your hackles get up and the first thing you want to do is march over to that other kid's house and have a word maybe with the parent or to call them up. What is the right response?
That's such a good question. You know, the right response is to never confront the bully or his or her parents directly. Instead, it's important to think about what is the setting where your child is being bullied. So if it's at school, then it's important to go to school counselor or other authorities within the school and talk about it. Take notes about the conversation that you had with the authorities at the school, and then follow up on it. So it's not just a one-time conversation, but it's a continual checking in to make sure that this is being resolved for your child. But addressing the bully directly can actually escalate the problem and make it more dangerous for anyone involved.
Is that counterintuitive for some people? I mean, I think about when I was growing up and my husband was growing up, and he has stories. He was bullied, my husband, for a little while in junior high, and ultimately, one of the teachers there took on that bully in a pretty direct way, in a way that would not probably be appropriate now, but it took care of the question, the problem that was going on. So are we in a different space about how you're supposed to handle these things?
Yeah, well, maybe. You know, we do have kind of this historical story about celebrating when the little guy beats the big guy, you know, when David beats Goliath. But really recently we've learned that that bullying has negative effects on both the bully and the bullier, and that the most efficient way to handle it is not by this kind of bullying behavior by authority figures, but actually really listening behavior and following through on creating environments where bullying doesn't happen.
How does bullying hurt the bullier?
Well, bullies, I guess would be the way to describe it, have all sorts of negative outcomes. So bullies tend to be more likely to get into fights, not surprisingly, to steal and vandalize property, to drink or smoke, and have poor grades. But, you know, they also have internal challenges as well. They tend to have lower self-esteem and even have suicidal thoughts. So, you know, being a bully, it might look like a really strong position, but bullies often are hurting as well, and honestly need support and help to minimize their negative behaviors just as much as the victim needs them.
And do you feel like those structures are in place now? If we're talking about a school setting, at least, if there is a child being bullied and the bully him or herself, I mean, is there are there resources there to support both of them with their own particular needs?
There are resources. So it's actually just been since the 1970s that this awareness, I think, of bullying as an essential topic to talk about and something to work on preventing even came about. But now in the United States, at least 30 states have laws against bullying, and that includes Wisconsin. And with those laws sometimes comes funding for programs. So, for instance, in Wisconsin, you can go to the Department of Public Instruction's website, and they have a whole page called A Comprehensive Approach to Bullying Prevention. And that's just the public face of the resources that they have. Each school would be aware of other resources that are available as well.
We're talking with Anna Clarkson right now, Digital Parenting Education Specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. And we're talking about how parents' behavior can have a big impact on how kids respond to bullying.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you deal with bullying that may impact your child? Do you talk to your kid about bullying? What do you talk about when you do? If you work in a school setting, what do you see? What role can parents play there? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and find a link to Anna's article on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking right now about bullying and how parents' own example is often the most effective safeguard against bullying. And what do you think? Do you agree with that? Is that your experience? You can call us at 800-642-1234 to tell us how you help your children cope with bullying. And what do you do if you find out your child is doing the bullying? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@WPR.org.
Anna Clarkson is with us. She's a digital parenting education specialist with UW Extension. She recently wrote a WisContext article called The Best Bullying Prevention is for Parents to Lead by Example. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have Marie on the line in Appleton. Marie, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I did feel compelled to call as a parent and one who has experienced a number of different types of school systems, parochial and public, very much experienced with a variety of children. On several observations that I have definitely made in the public and private school setting, I have seen just an unbelievable amount of teacher bullying that is overlooked by administration and a blind eye is turned to, which has a direct impact on children and how they feel about themselves and behave or take out the stress that that teacher created on them during the day on other children, which would be the only group that they feel they can have some influence over. Completely unaddressed, and I never hear it talked about in the news or by forums such as this. And then the other would be that I do think it's great to have a system where bullying is recognized in the school setting and that schools have some tools and alternatives to use to resolve the situation. But I was particularly seeing in the parochial school setting in particular is rampant bullying, not paid attention to by staff, complaints overlooked. Literally, as a parent, you would need to call the police to get involved to have anything really looked at seriously. No follow-through, no care about the bully, and no care about the child who's being bullied, with a direct impact on academics and happiness and overall health in their life.
Marie,
now,
thank
in the public
you.
School, sure.
Sure, go ahead. I think we got the gist of what you were saying there.
Sure. The public school setting, yes, bullying also happening from children to children, but almost at least a little bit of a response from administration or teachers if it was brought to their attention and some attempt at follow-through. Still nothing addressing teachers doing the bullying, but at least some attention being paid when a parent's complaining or a child's complaint about, you know, child-to-child bullying. So I'm surprised at the disparity, very disappointed with that, but would like to see some attention brought to all those areas.
Marie, thank you so much. And Anna Marie getting at that she thinks there's different levels of education about bullying and proper response, that it's not maybe a message and a strategy for helping bullying that has permeated all different types of schools. Public schools, she's saying, a little different. Parochial schools, a little different. Sometimes the teachers, she says, are doing the bullying. So what needs to happen to have schools be on the same page?
Well, Marie, thanks so much for your comments. And in terms of schools being on the same page, I think a really important point that Marie brought up is that even though I focused in this article with Rebecca Mather about parents and children, and that's why that was the focus, peer bullying was the focus, bullying does happen between adults bullying adults and also adults bullying children. And even if the the system may be a little ineffective, the first step is always to report a teacher, you know, within the school system. But then the next recommended step is also to follow up with law enforcement in your community. And I wanted to just also point out that there are additional resources beyond those that are offered by the school. Two that that come to mind immediately for me are, first of all, the Hope Line in Wisconsin. And so a Hope Line is a free service where you can text in 24/7 to crisis counselors and, you know, have a conversation about the bullying that's happening to you and get feedback. So in Wisconsin, you text Hope Line to 741-741, and that will connect you with counselors. And then the other resource, because parents, as we've talked about, really are an important line of defense for building up the ability to respond to bullying, is the No Bullying, and that's K-N-O-W, bullying app. That's from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And that's an app that just connects you to all sorts of resources, but also provides questions that you can ask with your child. So it doesn't solve the problem of what we can do to fix these problems necessarily in our communities or our schools, but it provides some good starting points.
Well, Marie, thank you so much for that call. As we talk right now about bullying with Anna Clarkson, digital parenting education specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension, she co-authored an article on WisContext called The Best Bullying Prevention is for Parents to Lead by Example. We've been talking a bit about that, broadening the conversation now in general, and you can call in and ask your question at 800-642-1234. And we'll take a next call from Sandra in Baraboo. Sandra, hi.
Hi. I have an open communication with both my kids. And my younger child, he was actually bullied outside of school by someone a couple years older than him. And I actually, once finding out what happened, we actually found out where he lived. We went to his home. I spoke to his mother. She did get her son to finally come to the door, but even speaking with his mom, it didn't get very far. She didn't feel that the action of throwing items at my son's head was very bad, I guess. So I was kind of disappointed in that way. However, I did show my son that, you know, we need to go. We need to have effective communication by not yelling and just point out what had happened, you know. And I did take it one step further. I did call the school, report the kid there, and you know what? As soon as I said the kid's name, they knew exactly who I was talking about. So he seemed to have been a problem, you know, for a while.
And Sandra, can I ask you, did you feel as though you would do it again to go directly to the child's home and his parent, or do you think next time you might just start with the school?
No, I like the thought that I went to the parent. You know, I may not have gotten very far, but like I said, I at least brought it to her attention. You know, I felt better about it, and I think my son did too, because they weren't in a school atmosphere where they have the principal there, kind of like they're both in trouble. You know, it was more just, you know, having a talk, and although it wasn't that effective, I think he felt better about it too. I would definitely do it again.
Sandra, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. And Anna, what about that? Sandra chose to go to the house, which is something you say can result in escalating of the problem. But on the other hand, you know, she, for instance, in this particular case, feels good about doing that. And is there something to be said about having, you know, what could be perceived as the strength and the self-confidence to have that face-to-face conversation?
Well, I think what I really like is that, Sandra, you did a lot of awareness building. So you informed the parent of the bully that this was happening, just in case they weren't aware that it was happening. Hopefully they take some action to support their child now. Then you also informed the school to build awareness so that if this happens to another child, you know, they're aware that this is a pattern and this happens, you know, is happening in several situations. And I think that another way that you could continue to really build this assertiveness or this strength in your son would be to continue this conversation of, well, this didn't happen at school. This happened in the setting outside of school, maybe where there isn't a lot of adult supervision. What am I going to do next time if there is a next time with this bullying? What can I do to stay safe and to respond in a way that is
respectful but keeps me safe. I think that can be a good way to kind of add another layer of protection and response.
And Anna, as we wrap up, bystanders can play a role in stopping bullying as it happens, because there might not be a parent there or an adult there. There could be a bunch of peers hanging out after school. How do parents get other kids, bystanders involved, and feel like they have the agency to stand up and intervene in that crucial moment? Just briefly, Anna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the ways that kids can learn to stand up and parents can model is by saying, supporting the person who's a victim. Hey, do you want to come eat lunch with us? It doesn't look like he likes that. Please stop. Or those students can also go find an adult to take care of them. And in those situations, having several friends together who say to the victim, hey, come with us. We'd like to hang out with you, can be a real strength and support for that person who's being bullied.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Anna Clarkson, Digital Parenting Education Specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. She co-wrote an article on WisConText called The Best Bullying Prevention is for Parents to Lead by Example. You can find that and a whole lot more at wisconText.org. And you can also share your stories over on the Central Time Facebook page.
The weather has been unpredictable lately, so we're searching for some non-meteorological signs of spring this year. You know, the robins and whatnot.
Well, the clocks move forward this weekend. You can brace yourself for an hour of lost sleep. I mean, I guess there are perks to that, too, but I think a lot of people are going to be tired. And producer Chris Molina gave us another, perhaps more hopeful sign of spring, Peeps-flavored Oreos.
Chris is a connoisseur of weird-flavored treats. The latest Oreo has a pink filling, replicating the taste and sort of the texture of Peeps. That's the Easter candy that I think more people look at than actually
eat. Those are the fluffy chicks that have marshmallows on the inside.
They seem like very much a non-food substance in some ways.
And yet people eat them. I think my kids have had them. Well, we got to try the Oreo Peeps today, and the verdict was they
could
have been worse.
Could have been worse, and there have been. Chris brings in a lot of these weird-flavored Oreos and other treats. The Swedish fish Oreo, we may have talked about that
on the
air.
That was the low point.
It was really bad. That was one of the worst things I've eaten that was
ever.
Deliberately sold as food. Yeah. The birthday cake one I was fine with.
The pumpkin spice
pumpkin
was good.
Spice,
oh, but you
I
can't
didn't
have
touch
cinnamon.
That. Yeah,
yeah, that was pretty tasty.
But Chris, of course, he'll get anything pumpkin spice.
Yeah, the Swedish fish, though, I have to wonder who sat there in Oreo corporate and said, this is a good idea.
So the Peeps Oreos, not so bad. It's a sign of spring here on Central Time.